Welcome to Juice Podcast. My name's Emily Harmon and I'm in Malaga today and I'm joined by...
Gustavo.
Bill Idea.
From Panama.
And who are you, Gustavo?
Well, I'm just a random guy from Panama who just started to make a living out of food. I started with my husband about 3 years ago to just make food and put that in our blog, which is our plant-based world.
Nice. And for everybody that's tuning in, how would we find you and how would they know you? Like, so website, Instagram?
Website, ourplantbasedworld.com. And in Spanish, there's nomadasgourmet.com. Same thing, our plant-based world in Instagram and all social handles like TikTok and YouTube.
Yeah, great. So I think today we're doing something a little bit different that we don't always do on Juice. Occasionally, we've done some food and wine pairing, but Gustavo and I are good friends and we decided that it would be really interesting to actually see some of the food and some of your own recipes that we've got here with the idea of if we were going to have the perfect kind of healthy, delicious picnic, this might be what we would do.
Exactly. This would be the idea of what we consider a good, nice and healthy picnic and grabbable food, finger food that can pair very well with the fresh wine that you're bringing us today.
I've picked three bottles of wine that are actually from my import business, Sublime Wine, because I thought they're quite cool. Because I think with a picnic and also or in like a tapas style or when you've got lots of different things on the table, like actually you've got quite a few options of things that you can do wine-wise, I think. So we're going to obviously taste that and I really want to know what you think as you go. Like, how much do you think about like wine when you're creating dishes?
Well, a lot, because I love wine and usually when we go on picnics, we love to have wine. Although I love beer, I'm more of a wine person. So usually I go for fresh wines, like white wine, rosé wines, and then I try to think what would pair well with that without too much thinking about having a whole plate of food, more of a, something that is grabbable, that with sharp flavor and combine well with fresh notes.
Great. I'm going to pour us like the first wine so we have something in our glass because it feels like really inappropriate to not have a glass of wine in front of us. Whilst I'm doing that, maybe you can tell us what's on the menu today.
Sure. So we have some dippables. We have just a Lebanese traditional hummus. And we also decided to have a second option, which is a beet hummus. So we had something, not only something savory, but something that of course is savory, but also has sweet notes that we could pair with. So those are our dippables. And then we have some Moroccan bread and some chips to pair that. And we also have some grilled veggies because sometimes it just feels like, you know, just dippables with dough and bread and you want something fresh as well. So I went for a couple of roasted veggies such as fennel and broccoli so we could just dip into them as well.
Great. That looks really good, actually. I'm very much eyeing up those little mushrooms that are on that plate.
Yeah. And then, well, we also have some vegetable paella and some tofu sticks. I like pairing tofu. Usually you go with soy sauce and so on, but since we're surrounded by Mediterranean food, we took this tofu sticks, which are like, they have some pasta, so they make it very crispy. And then the seasonings are basil and oregano, olive oil. So usually not your normal tofu.
Yes.
More like Mediterranean tofu. Right.
Awesome. What should we start with? I mean, first of all, we'll have a sip of that wine, I think. So the first wine that we've dived into here is the Quinta do Amizio Vigna Verde 2022, which is a wine that's made by a guy called Antonio Montero, and he's located in Aminho, which is the southern part of Vigna Verde. I really love Portugal for wine because I think it's still a place where you can get really good value wine. I mean, I think it's one of the cheapest places to eat seafood in the whole of Europe when you're holidaying there. It's just like so good. Obviously, we're eating plant-based food tonight, but I'm a big seafood fan too. But I thought with this, thinking about the context of a picnic being, like when I think about the wines that I want to pair with food, I don't just think about the food. I think about the company. I think about where we're going to be. And obviously we're recording here inside, but we're taking our picnic outdoors later to enjoy that. And I think, you know, in the sun, having something that's like fresh and light, and particularly because of the food that you've got here is like, it's very healthy. A lot of like fresher flavors there. I think it could be, yeah, a nice option. So this is option number one. Mm-hmm. And I also think when you're going for a picnic, you don't have to pick one wine. If you're going to drink more than one bottle, you could have different wines.
Yeah.
But yeah, have a taste, see what you think.
I love it. It has like this kind of, I think of apples.
Yeah.
Probably crisp flavors. Yeah. Gooseberry.
Yeah.
And I think it would be good to pair it with something that it's creamy, like to see how it balances out in your mouth. Probably something like crispier as well, like the truffle stick. So I would try a little.
I mean, let's do it.
Too. Yeah.
Boom. That's delicious. I've actually never done tofu like that. I like the idea of like making it crispy, and the herbs are really nice. Salt as well, salt and pepper as well, or just herbs?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You put salt and pepper on the...
I put pepperoncino. Mm-hmm. Probably I would add a little bit more salt, but usually when I'm going for picnics and so on, I bring a little bit of the salt because I'm the kind of person who likes to eat salty, and not everyone likes saltiness. So I always bring a little bit of salt, and just so everyone can sprinkle a little bit on top of whatever they fancy.
I like that. Very good. I like the crunchiness. Yeah, I think with this as an option, Vino Verde, like, you know, it's a low alcohol wine, so it's light in body. It's only 11.5%. So hot summery days, or if you know, maybe you've got a group of friends that like to drink a lot of wine, then maybe it could be a good choice.
Exactly. They also have a very nice price tag, so it's a nice wine if you want to bring a couple of them and not feel like you're making a hole in your pocket.
Yeah, and I think actually here, like, I haven't picked anything crazy expensive, but I mean, the other two are like kind of double the price. So I think it is, it's good to always, I think, look for a more earthy, grounded option in terms of price point too. What else? I'm just thinking as well, this could also be quite nice maybe with an olive. I'm going to try one of those.
Since we're in Spain and we always have
amazing olives.
Amazing olives. And I love here in Malaga, I actually discovered that when we moved here, the fact that they make these seasoned olives, which what they do is that they break the olive. They call it aceitunas rotas.
Mm-hmm.
So they break them before putting them in brine. So that makes them absorb more of the seasonings. And I become such a fan of that. So we always keep a big pot of these kind of olives in our fridge.
I mean, they're delicious. Well, and I mean, in terms of your journey into doing your food blog, where did that come from? Like, how did you, like, what started it? Like, what inspired it?
Well, just right before the pandemics, I decided to ditch the corporate world. I used to work in marketing but I always loved food. And throughout the last couple of years, I've gone to culinary school. Some of them were just like short courses. Mm-hmm. And the last one was a master's degree. It was one year when we were living in Mexico. And then we took the decision to just travel. And before I got into a new job, just think more about what we really wanted to continue doing. And at that time, we were also moving to Europe. And then the pandemics happened. And, you know, the pandemics made a lot of us change and rethink the things that we were doing. And in our case, what that meant was Joaquin really wanted to get more into the videography and taking more pictures.
And all the listeners, Joaquin is your partner.
Joaquin is my partner.
In business and life.
Business and life.
Yes.
Yeah, so we wanted to do that. We were like, what can we do together? And then I started to explore and to see what was blogging about, if you could actually make a living out of it. So we made a plan, and then we moved to Italy, and there we started. So we started cooking and developing more and more recipes. And then 1 year later, we were able to make a living out of it. And it's been already 3 years and I think we're not coming back.
Yeah, great. I mean, what I really appreciate as well about your recipes, not only do they visually look so beautiful that they're actually quite inspiring to prepare, is that like actually they are actually healthy. Because I think as a meat eater, and a very proud meat eater, like sometimes I struggle to, like, I mean, I obviously want to reduce my meat consumption and I want to buy the meat that I do consume. I'm more mindful about like getting it from smaller farms, not industry produced. You know, in the same way as sourcing wines of good provenance, I think about the ingredients that I'm buying as well. And I think often the thing that gets me is that sometimes the vegan options or the plant-based options aren't necessarily always healthier.
Yes, sir.
And I like that, like, actually, like, that's a priority of yours, is like actually thinking about it being a healthier option, not just being plant-based for the sake of it.
Exactly. That's one of our the things that drive our ethos. We always call healthifying non-flavors, because what most of people struggle with when they are trying to make a change or just reduce their meat consumption is the fact that they feel like plant-based food is just boring. And that I took that in and I started to recreate a lot of these flavors that have this nostalgia component that you feel like, oh, I wouldn't be able to do that. I wouldn't be able to dish teas or whatever, which is a common one. So that's that was my starting point. And because although I love veggies, I mean, I always ate meat and fish, and I am very related to those flavors. And being a foodie, I didn't want to miss that. So I started not only recreating those flavors, but also trying to make them healthy, because again, I mean, you could have a lot of different meatless options that are, as you said before, not necessarily healthy. And I just wanted to make them both healthy and flavorful.
Yeah, like a lot of the meat alternatives, like the fake meats, are kind of can be problematic.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think also just coming at it from a flavor point of view as well, of like, you know, food like wine is something that's really about pleasure for me. It's like I really... It's like, especially when you have it with good company, it's like that for me is like the ultimate, you know, like the most important piece of furniture in my house is the dining table. And I want to sit there, I want to sit there with company and I want to enjoy what I'm doing, like what I'm eating. And I think as somebody who like really appreciates living through my senses, it's, I really, really enjoy others that do as well. Yeah, very good. And what, I mean... What are those mushrooms there then? I want to know what they are.
Yeah, those are enoki mushrooms and shiitake mushrooms.
Yeah.
We're approaching the end of the season with mushrooms, but we love mushrooms in every single way. So I use them a lot for risottos. I grill them. A couple of weeks ago with my husband, we just discovered these huge boletus mushrooms that they have here. They're like the porcini mushrooms, just like half of a pound each, and we just found them and we just
cut them raw
and grill them, and they're one of the most amazing mushrooms we have had. So we're having a mushroom season, you know. Every time I think about having food, I'm like, where are the mushrooms, what kind of mushrooms we're having? And yeah, here in Spain it's a great place to get mushrooms.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is I mean, it's in Italy that where you see it, where you get freshly cut porcini just with olive oil and then sometimes slices of parmesan. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's like... Last week, so every day we ended up making a recipe out of it. So the post is there, it's just freshly new. And yeah, it's so we can dive in, probably have a little bit of those mushrooms to see.
I definitely want to.
Cooling.
So strong flavor.
Yeah.
They look so thin and so
delicate,
and they are
very intense. So yeah, quite umami actually, those ones. Very nice. I've already finished that wine. You'll have to finish yours too.
I'll have to finish.
On juice, we don't hold back with drinking the wine.
Oh no.
Yeah.
not in this deal.
Okay, so the next wine that I'm opening that I bought. So when I was thinking about options, I was obviously thinking about wines that I just love, but I was thinking about different styles that I think would be helpful. So light, fresh, white, relatively inexpensive, the Vigna Verde. Second option I was thinking was like bubbles, because there's never an inappropriate time for bubbles, in my opinion. And then I was like going back to like, you know, like being outside, maybe it's a warm day. And then I was like, rosé bubbles, without it being too cliche. So the next wine is from a producer called Villa Calicantis, who are located very close to Lago di Garda, so Lake Garda in the Veneto in the north of Italy.
Just right where we used to live.
Really?
Yeah, one hour away from.
Yeah.
We used to live in northern Milano.
Yeah.
And Lake Garda, they have such amazing vineyards. That
yes.
We tried some of the best wines we had tried ever in that area.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Well, this one is like one of the bottles that I always want to have at home in my fridge because it's a joy to drink. So the wine's called Salazzo and it's a pet nat, so single fermentation. So the wine, when it ferments, you chill it down, you move it into bottle, you put the crown cap that you just see there on top, and then it finishes fermenting in bottle. And that the natural gases that would usually escape during fermentation dissolve into the wine. And that's how we get this style of sparkling.
Wow.
And it's a blend of grapes. So it's Molinara, Corvina, Rondinella with a little bit of Sangiovese. So all local grapes to that area. And those grapes are kind of known because they're the same red grapes that you find in Valpolicella wines.
Yeah.
Please taste it. So I live in Berlin in Germany, as you know. And we have this like non-alcoholic drink called like a Rhabarberschorle, which is like a rhubarb spritzer. So it's like rhubarb cordial or rhubarb juice with sparkling water. And I always say that this wine's like a Rhabarberschorle for adults because it's got that lovely kind of tangy sweetness about it. Like I still think there's like blood orange, there's lovely berry flavors, but that rhubarb note kind of comes through. And obviously it's unfiltered, like all the wines we're trying here. So the Vigna Verde that we had at the beginning was organic. This is organic and the farming here is biodynamic. So really a couple who are very focused not only on making delicious wines, but have that ethos behind of like really mindful in terms of the wines that they're producing as well.
I love
the way they're growing the wines.
I love that. That's actually one of the reasons when people ask us, like, why do you go plant-based? And it was never about appetite or ditching meat or anything. It was more about because we have always been like very into environmentalism and so on, and how can we reduce our CO2 footprint, our carbon footprint, and that's how we started. It wasn't about it was the reason, and that was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I think always when it comes to wine and whatever we're going to consume, having that consciousness and, you know, like, what is it that we're what am I consuming, where I'm putting my money, is something that the more we harness and we are the more conscious we are when we are at the supermarket or a wine shop, we're putting, you know, what we can into, you know, our world. So I really love your approach to how you pick your wines and how you bring them to life in such this kind of feast.
Yeah. And how do you find this wine, like when you taste it, like what's your experience of it? Because I think often with natural wines and biodynamic, natural wines, that this is a natural wine, and I'm always very careful about saying that because I think sometimes it's a term that can be a bit polarizing for a lot of people. But I think for me, the wines are not always just fruity, right? Like when you try sort of more commercial industrial produced wines, they're very primary in the flavors. You get a lot of apple, a lot of fresh fruit flavors. But sometimes with natural wines, they have other elements to them, a savoriness sometimes and things like that. Like, what do you think of this?
This wine makes me think of grapefruit and blood orange juice, and it really makes me want to pair it with that bit hummus. You know, probably because it's pink and it sounds too obvious, but it's just because those notes I think would pair very well. And also, lately with Joaquin, my husband, we have been so much into fermenting, and he has become so keen about kombucha. Mm-hmm. So we always have like lots of pots of kombucha going on, and I find it similar to that kombucha kind of flavor that is that fermentation is fresh fermentation, you know, and I have falling in love with it, that I find myself even like having kombucha for breakfast.
Yeah,
so
really?
Yep. Very dangerous. I mean,
yeah.
I'm about to confuse this with kombucha.
I actually do believe that like there's not an inappropriate time to drink this particular wine. Like I really, again, I mean, Gwen and I did an episode on Pet Nat, which is this style of sparkling, and it was like, when can you not drink it? It's like, you can have it for breakfast, could have it for lunch, could just have it in the afternoon on the beach or on a walk. You could have it like at the end of a meal, because there's something very energizing about it,
yeah,
but at the same time very like joyful. Like when I try wines like this, I also think about like how I feel when I drink them. Okay. And I think there's like the flavor experience, but it's like it's energizing, but in kind of a grounded way. So it's like when you've had a really big meal and you're like, I don't know, should I have more red wine? Having something like this, it just, it's like a reset button.
Exactly.
It's dangerous because of that, but.
I like dangerous.
Yeah. The Pet at reset. Have you tried that with the beetroot? Oh, that beetroot hummus is amazing. And the texture of it is like gloss. It's like how I could describe it. It's so smooth. Mm-hmm. What's your secret?
Well, a good blender.
Okay.
But the secret is using ice water. So what I'm blending any kind of hummus, I would just grab a glass of water, put a big block of ice, mm-hmm. And then that ice cube, and then I start like adjusting for texture, what's the texture that I want to get to. But that is what actually makes the hummus so creamy.
Yeah, right. So ice is part of the process.
Ice is part of the process. I mean, I don't throw the ice cube. I just put it in water, so I have...
So the water's super cold.
Very cold water.
Yeah.
And then I start adding it to the blender. Just as
almost like when you make smooth pastry, right? Like everyone says, like a good baker's meant to have cold fingers, no? Like, yeah. I heard that. Like, I don't know if that's actually a thing, but it's like you don't want the pastry to get, like, too hot.
Exactly. Yeah. I love it.
So good.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to have to eat another piece because... This is amazing. And you've put little, like, the Nigella, what is that?
Yeah, that's harissa. I mean, I usually put it on paprika, but since this is a little bit of a sweeter hummus, I didn't want, I relate paprika more to, like, the sweetness of paella and traditional hummus. So, but I went for harissa and used to have it a little bit of a spicier note, a little bit more earthy note. So, but it has the same colorful effect. And I usually, when I... You know, if you want to know how to present your hummus very well, it's very easy. You just take a spoon, the back of the spoon, and you do that. You do those rounds, and then you just fill those pockets with a little bit of olive oil. And then the final notes is always I put something red on top, so to bring out the looks, and some sesame seeds. So that's usually how.
So that's white and black sesame on there.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure if it was like Nigella seeds or.
Black and white sesame seeds, but it's all about the looks. Oh, well, at the end of the day, tahini. I mean, hummus has tahini, and so tahini is inside of the hummus already.
Yeah.
But then I like to use a little bit more of the raw ones, or you can also use toasted sesame seeds to put on top just to enhance the looks.
Very nice. I mean, it is beautiful. I saw you doing that with a spoon in the kitchen before, and I was like, such a simple trick.
It's a very simple trick. Yep. Actually, I learned that while... when we were studying with the blog, we started to take some online courses about like how to present food, and I had already created the first hummus, but it just wasn't looking great. We were like, I don't know, how do I make hummus look great? And then we went into this course, and then I started to do the end. So we changed the whole pictures of the first shooting because it was like such a simple trick, but it's just very easy to plate a good hummus. But if you don't know it, you don't do it. You just put like the big pot of cream there and you have to make it look good.
And I mean, obviously we're hearing all the good stories, but has there been any major, like for lack of a better word, fuck-ups along the way? When you've been like, I heard this would be really good. Like, how do we... And then it's gone like been an absolute disaster. Have you got any like horror stories or funny stories that happen making... I don't know, like maybe you forgot to put the lid on the blender and you end up with...
Yeah,
glossy hummus all over his way. I don't know, but like, has there been any? Has there been any?
Well, they happen all the time. Right? They happen all the time. Okay. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to plating, what happens is that, as you can see here, this is where we do our shootings. But when we moved here, we were not able to find the kitchen of our dreams. So we decided that, well, we'll cook everything there. And then when we are making our shootings, we make them here. And sometimes just not cooking in the right setting, like actually in a kitchen,
makes timings and stuff and things being born at the same time. And I tend to be an optimizer.
I've noticed.
So I'm always like, okay, we're doing this. Well, we do that. I have that in the oven. And then several times I've been burning things. So burning things is common, but I think I have burn more things than you could ever imagine or that you would ever burn.
That's how really?
I'm a burner. But yeah, I mean, usually it doesn't happen to me when I'm just cooking my regular food.
Yeah.
When we are, you know, like going back and forward in the middle of shootings, yeah, that happens. And then sometimes like it can get into my nerves because, you know, in order to make a shooting, you have to do your chopping, you have to do your stuff, you have to plan everything. And then you just everything in the middle of the shooting. So yeah, I mean, so that's the most common thing. And then, when it comes to
any weird flavors, have you ever been like, I thought this would be really great, where you've tried to reinvent something and then you were like, that was disgusting?
Well, actually, with those toffee sticks, which I now love, when I started making them, the reason I got into them was because every time you eat tofu, it's like soy sauce involved. It's like, because it's an Asian thing, you know, tofu is from Asia. And so it's the natural way of seasoning tofu is soybeans, you know, the soy sauce and so on. And they're always like, yeah, but sometimes I just want to have that protein into a Mediterranean dish that I'm creating. So I started experimenting like, okay, I want to have a Mediterranean tofu. And you know, I have to say that the first couple of times didn't come out right. I mean, it was only until the third or fourth time that I tried, but probably just because, I don't know, I was trying with some herbs that didn't fit. And then I went back to the beginning and I was like, okay, what's the starting point? Mediterranean. When I think about Mediterranean, although there are so many herbs, I'm like, well, oregano, basil, olive oil, and balsamic vinegar. And that's what it's so I screwed it so many times before getting into the recipe, and then I just was like, I need to get back to the roots. I just wanted something Mediterranean. And what is more Mediterranean than olive oil and basil and oregano?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And it's such a simple thing to do. Like, I think what I really appreciate about this is, because if I do a picnic, I'm a little bit lazy, right, honestly. So I might be like, I'm going to go to that deli. I'm going to pick up that cheese, that cured meat, right? Like as a meat eater. And then maybe I'll then possibly get like some cucumber, cut that up. And then I'll have like some rock salt on the side that I can sprinkle over it before I eat that. But like making hummus and like seeing like the difference in the flavor and like the texture of something like that just is like, I mean, I could just eat that all day. And I think this is just like, what I really appreciate about this is it's like small tweaks on stuff that actually anyone can prepare.
Yeah, and also there are a couple of other tricks, you know, because today we started with the whole thing and I'm very keen to do everything homemade. So for instance, today we don't have it here because that was for our coffee, but Joaquin was like, hey, we don't have any milk and what we're having with our coffee. And I was like, well, should we make any homemade milk? And he's like, what do we have? Oats. Okay, so we made oats milk. Same thing with the hummus. We're like, okay, the chickpeas. And I was like, oh, but we don't have any canned chickpeas. I was like, oh, but we have a lot of dried chickpeas. So Instant Pot, I mean, we have an Instant Pot, but it's the kind of thing that you just like put and you just close it.
Yeah, pressure cooker.
Pressure cooker, and you're not actively cooking. You just put something in there, you just close it, and then you put baking soda on those chickpeas, and that makes them silky.
You know? Right.
So if you want
to make... What is that? Like, what does that do?
I don't know. I read once about, like, what's the chemistry involved, and I understood it. Now, right now, I can't remember exactly what is it, but it does make a difference. And so you can do it in two moments. If you have the time and you thought about your hummus yesterday, you put them to soak.
Yeah.
And you put 1 teaspoon of baking soda.
Okay.
Then you throw that water away when you're making your hummus. But when you're going to boil them or pressure cook them, add another one of those. And that makes your chickpeas so silky. And then the ice water, the cold water. So those are two of the blender, of course, you need a good blender. But when you add those things, you have the perfect silky hummus.
And I've got a question, but this might just be because I'm a bit of a noob when it comes to preparing chickpeas. Because when you've canned chickpeas, they've obviously got that outer shell on it, right? So I've learned that, you know, you can give them a bit of a soak or a rinse, and then you can get those little shells off. And apparently they're more digestible, or maybe you're less gassy.
Exactly.
Is it the same for dry chickpeas?
It is exactly the same. The chickpeas that we use today are a very small kind of chickpeas that they have here in Spain, and there's almost no shell to them.
Okay.
But when you add the baking soda, actually it makes that skin pop up like easily. So it's not that you have to then
give them one by one.
You just do that shake, and then it all comes to the surface. Get rid of all of that, and just that that makes them much more digestible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can even do that, like, to soften your chickpeas if you're making falafel, for instance. To make falafel, you don't have to cook the chickpeas. You know that? People did it.
Were they? Did it? I didn't. I had that eyebrow raised. Okay, tell me more about that. Yeah. I've never made falafel because the whole idea of it is very intimidating.
Yeah, so...
Oh, tell me more.
So you don't cook chickpeas to make falafel. What you do is you need to soak them overnight.
Okay.
So 8 hours. Yep. And you put a little bit of baking soda if you want to make it extra soft. Not needed, because sometimes you just want them to be crunchy, you know? So you soak them, and they triple their size sometimes. And then you get rid of that water. And then you, for the falafel, you just put everything in a food processor. The dry chickpeas that now are soaked are huge, you know, because they're filled with water. Parsley and all your condiments... You process everything, and then you just make the balls and put that. If you want to be really, really a perfectionist, you make the balls, you put them in the...
If you want to optimize...
you put them in the fruits.
Okay.
So they...
Firm up
a little bit, and they get a little bit more compact, and then you fry them.
Okay, and you're frying them like... How are you frying yours?
I like to use a big skillet, because you have to give them room. So don't overcrowd your skillet. I mean, because the more oil can be in contact with the falafel ball, the better they are going to be cooked. And another really good thing to know about which oil to use, for instance, is grapeseed oil. It's the perfect one because it has a very high fission point. So you can
turn into a
exactly
and you healthier.
Can, yeah, it's healthier because the falafels do not absorb as much. You have to fry them like it's a 15-second thing, you know, very high temperature.
Yeah,
not overcrowding, but then just like
in batches, small batches,
and but you do everything in 10 minutes. I mean, depending on how many people you're feeding, but.
So I've got a question on the plant-based life thing, but that's just something I'm segueing away a little bit from the overall topic of the picnic. But it just came to me, what about things like zucchini fritti? How do you do that without egg?
Usually, well, there's one thing about, you know, the aquafaba, which is the water that comes out
chickpeas.
Of the chickpeas.
Well, okay. Just like for people that have like the vegan whiskey sour, and they use the chickpea water.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you can use those things, and then you use, like, for instance, for these tofu sticks, you use cornstarch. So you season them so the tofu absorbs, you know, the marinade ingredients and the flavors, and then you just use a little bit of cornstarch because that's what makes them crusty. So when you cannot you don't want to use eggs, you can use things like cornstarch, which is a thickener. Aquafaba is also a thickener.
Okay.
And actually, I'm not a big fan of just like having sweets like merengue, you know, which, you know, but you can have, you know, how you make a merengue that is vegan is aquafaba and sugar.
That's for all the English people out there. That's meringue. Yeah, okay. But does that come from, like, can you taste it? Like, the taste... It just tastes less eggy. Meringues taste very egg whitey, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. It just tastes less eggy. Yeah, definitely. And also, when it comes to baking, what I use to replace all the eggs is just I make chia eggs or flaxseed eggs, which is basically one tablespoon of linseed or flax meal and chia, and then you add 3 to 4 tablespoons of water. Warm water, 5 minutes and it becomes a gel.
Okay.
So that gel, then you use to whatever thing you're making, and it becomes, it's just a thickening agent and a binding agent.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I just have to think more expansively. I find my approach to me.
But at the end of the day, it's like a table. So one tablespoon of chia is a tablespoon. That's an egg.
Okay.
And one tablespoon of chia.
But so, I mean, I'm going to share, because I think we often, like on Juice, we do share some embarrassing stories and stuff, right? So I remember once me trying to get into chia for the first time. Oh my gosh. So I'd started adding chia seeds just to my cereal in the morning. And I was like, okay, like these seeds, like I think I'd probably eat quite a few of them. So I started like taking a couple of tablespoons on, right? And did that the first day and was like, okay, didn't really feel any different. I guess I'll put some more in there. Like still felt like I could eat more food. And I actually ended up very constipated. Yeah, because I'd put so much chia on and I hadn't allowed it. Apparently, because I didn't know at the time, like you have to actually let it sit.
Yeah, I have to let it sit.
And I didn't. So they obviously just like kind of expanded in me. And I was just like, that was a lesson that was like.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why when you made this other. Yeah.
This is like. But I think we have to tell people that. It's just like, I wish someone had told me that. Like, it was like for like, there was a good 12 hours where I was like, what have I done? Like, why? But you not have any experience. Like, I'm trying to find out if you've had any experiences like that. But
that's actually. That's actually how, you know, that's why a lot of times when you're making the overnight oats, to make your breakfast one day before, one night before, you put some chia eggs because they age in the fridge during the night. So when you have them.
Age, that's a very elegant way of putting it. They were aging inside of me. They're recording. Yeah.
So this is the orange.
Yeah. So this is the wine that you were like, orange wine? What orange wine? It's orange wine. So the next wine that I've just poured for us, which I just snuck in there, is from Orsi Sambito. And this is a wine coming from just outside of Bologna, about 30 minutes in the Colli Bolognese, the hills outside of Bologna. And this is a winery that was set up, I think he bought the vineyards in 06 or 07, Federico Orsi, that's his surname.
Okay.
And the wine's called Posca Bianca. It's a non-vintage wine because actually it's a blend of multiple vintages. This bottle of wine, my go-to wines at home, kind of all three of these, that's maybe also why I bought them, but this, I always have a bottle of this in my fridge at home because I think there's something about it that's just so pleasurable and satisfying for my taste that I'm just like, so good. So what does a solera mean? It means that there's one large concrete tank that he's been every year making wine and putting it into that tank and blending it in. And then bottling a proportion of that every year. So each year, the wine changes a little bit. And I think it changes in a really good way because the wine ends up a little bit more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's also a little bit like a storybook. Like I think about it, I get a little bit more sort of sentimental about it because I also think it's like the story of the winery as well from when it started. He makes a red version, but it's like you get to see the evolution, you get to see, just like with people,
mm-hmm.
like how we change with time and we become sometimes more complicated, but also we, there's complexity, there's things about us. We're not just kind of young and fun and playful little babies anymore. We're people who have been through things. And like this wine is very much like that for me. And what I really appreciate about it, because I think orange wine can be quite challenging for a lot of people because it looks really different. It's often cloudy. It's this dark color, which everybody's been told, like, well, if you got given a white wine that's got this like orange color, there's something wrong with it. So like already it's very challenging for some people to question, like, am I going to like this wine? Because they're looking at something they've been told is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you try it, it's, again, there's fruit there, but there's savouriness. There's a saltiness that runs through this wine. But there's different texture to it. There's tannin, there's this dryness, maybe a little bit of bitterness to some degree. But I think for me, that's very pleasurable because it's like it's like a three-dimensional or four-dimensional experience of a wine, because there's so much happening. How it smells is different to how it tastes. And
is this this wine that is made? They just kept the technique of the Roman ages, that they just like use the same place where they just keep like aging the wine.
Actually, so there's two things with this wine, because sometimes he blends in just white wine, and then I think there's some skin contact wine there too. So this isn't a typical orange wine in that way. The Solera thing is something that's been done for a long time, where you, like, I mean, also we're here in Malaga, which is so close to sherry country, right?
Mm-hmm. So, Moscato and all the
Moscato. Yeah, and so like Fino, Manzanilla, Amontillado, these are all Solera wines. Mm-hmm. They're wines that are multiple vintages that have been put together. And the benefit of that is that you get something more consistent, but you also get something more complex. So it's very interesting in that way, a non-vintage wine. But the skin contact, like orange style of wine, is not, it's way older than Roman times. Mm. States back for like, you know, like, I think it's like 8,000 or 9,000 years to Georgia as the origin. And it's an uninterrupted history of making wine, skin contact wine in that way as well. So it's not a new concept. It's become a new concept to a lot of people because it kind of fell out of fashion with the industrial movement throughout the whole of the world. Post-World War II, like where we saw a lot of people moving away from regional varietals and more artisan wine production, and everything was kind of mechanized. Mm-hmm. And then there was chemical use in our farming practices. This isn't just for wine. This is obviously for food. Mm-hmm. Vegetables are another thing, right? So...
And there's this whole concept about like it being used for like as an energetic drink, right? Like to have some more energy, you know, when you consume it, and just like be able to go and do other things. And I was reading a little bit about like this, it's kind of why that really piqued my attention. And yeah, because it feels fizzy, but at the same time, super easy to drink. It just feels like, I don't know, it's... Again, very drinkable. I mean, just like not like, okay, I'm gonna just, I need wine. It's more about like, I need a drink, something very easy to drink that almost feels like juice, but in a way that you're still having your, you know, your booze, but it's light. It's very light.
Yeah, and I think my thought around why I bought this for the picnic pairing, or, you know, like it's almost like mezze tapas pairing here also as well, right? But like, I think for this was like, when you go to Georgia, which is the home of sort of skin contact wine, you sit at a table at somebody's home and, you know, the whole family have prepared this like plentitude of dishes. So you've got all of these different dishes in front of you that taste radically different. And often there's like stronger, bolder flavors, things like garlic, onion, maybe spice. And they put one wine on the table. And it's this orange wine that goes there and it just works with everything. And that's why I bought this, because I actually thought there's something about it where it can handle like umami, savory flavors. It can like the toasty flavors of the nut, like it can have nuts.
You can die, like the toasty flavor, yeah. Almost, which I just toasted right before, so they're very toasty.
Yeah.
And that is perfectly.
Yeah.
Works perfectly.
And I think, you know, like, again, it's like, these are options for people to play with. Like you could try all of them, you could pick one, but I feel like skin contact wine works really well. But also, again, this like this wine from Federico really fits into like just like how I just like feel joyful when I drink this wine. And I think if I'm picnicking and I'm outside and I'm with friends, like I like that there's like pleasurable wine in front of me that like doesn't, I don't have to intellectualize it. I can just drink it, and it's
sure that it's gonna work.
yeah and I think this would be probably really good. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, there's this paella here
blinking at us, right?
Yeah looking at us. Let's have a look.
It works very well with this offering. Like that.
Yeah, it's really good. I can handle, I mean, like paella can be quite strong in flavour, eh?
Exactly.
And actually it works really well. Yeah.
It balances it out. And it's just like...
Yeah, and I think for me, what's really interesting about us doing this today, like trying these wines, trying all of this food, is like, actually, like, I think a lot of people are intimidated. Like, a lot of people are intimidated by wine in general, especially when it comes to like a formal seated, mm-hmm. like in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, wine can be elitist. It can be very inaccessible and it can be overwhelming because you're like, what is that wine I've never heard of? And that name, I don't know. And then you're already trying to pick food that maybe you're not familiar with mm-hmm. because it's not the food you cook at home. And I think what's really important for me is like, actually, like, just find a wine that you love, like, that you enjoy, that is pleasurable. Like, find the food that's pleasurable for you. Like, that's more of a priority, I think, for me. Like, and the more and more I do the job that I do, the more I'm like, I just want to drink stuff that, like, makes me feel good. I want to eat food that makes me feel good. And it doesn't have to be overly curated. I think it's nice. Like, you can find, like, really beautiful pairings. Like, obviously, we found a couple today that are, like, really cool. But, like, how nice is it also, like, to not complicate, like, what would I really like to drink when I'm with people that I love being around? Like, what's going to make me feel really, like, what do I want to eat when I'm around those people? Like, looking at it in a, like, a more holistic sense, mm-hmm. rather than like a textbook sense of like, well, if you have this cheese, you have to have this wine, you know, like,
yeah, yeah, it's,
or you when you're having mushrooms, you must have this, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, like people think of like earthy flavors, like, oh, you have to go with red wine, or yeah. you're having seafood, you have to go with white wine. It's not always like that, and that's the spirit of what we made here, because of course not with the paella, because paella, actually those are paella leftovers from yesterday. We had a really nice day, you know, and we were experimenting with lots of food, and we went to different restaurants. But for instance, yesterday also when we woke up, we were like, okay, because we love using, and if you have been following our plant-based world for a while, I mean, we're really into juicing and smoothies and mm. all drinks in general. And there's even a wine pairing section in the blog. We juiced, and although we love juicing, one of the things that never felt very right about juicing is that we had a lot of pulp, you know, after yeah. juiced.
What do you do with, I wondered that. Do you compost it?
Those crackers are juice pulp. Those are that's the juice pulp from yesterday.
Well, okay, you need to explain that to me because I don't understand how that works.
I will. So we have a lot of different recipes with juice pulp, but today when I woke up and remember you asked me like, oh, you even managed to cook and you went to the shop, and I was like, no, I didn't go to the shop. I was like, and what's about the food? It's like, well, just the things that were here. And so we had the juice pulp from yesterday, and when we have juice pulp, we just need to repurpose it. So this is a recipe that we created inspired by something here in Andalusia. They have something that is called regañas. It's like regañas, yeah? And basically, those are like little crackers that are not made with juice pulp. They're just crackers that you mm-hmm. buy in just to nippables, just like yeah. little crackers. But we knew how to make them because we have a friend who she has cooking classes, and we went to visit her and we cooked with her. Bernardita Cocina is her name. She's amazing. She's from Chile and she has her cooking school here. So we went to meet her, and I learned from her how to make Andalusian regañas. So I had this idea, learned from her, and then when we came back, we were like, try to use the juice pulp to make crackers, you know, using the same technique, just like using like any kind of flour that we have and just season it with onion powder or whatever you have. So those have basically that's chia seeds,
yep.
flax meal.
Chia seeds, the real insight. What are they saying?
Only a tablespoon for a whole bunch. Yeah, and that's the binding agent there, yeah. and also the juice pulp. And but of course, one thing that you have to take into consideration is that sometimes you use very sweet stuff. But sometimes, yesterday was less sweeter. It was celery, it was carrots, cucumbers. It only has like one apple for 4 glasses of juice. So it was not a very sweet juice. So sometimes I'm very mindful yeah. of the pulp that I'm using to make what kind of recipes, because if I'm going to be making like cupcakes, then I use my
sweet juice pulp to make cupcakes and, you know, in baking. But if I'm gonna be making something savory, I try to use more things that are like, you know, celery, cucumber, and so on. So yes, so this is we are all about the zero waste and just like reusing and repurposing everything, because we don't like anything to go to waste.
I mean, that's amazing, because I did have a thought when I saw the pulp in the blend, like the bottom part of the blender yesterday. I thought, I wonder if they compost that. If I actually had a thought about it. And now I know.
Yeah, and you ate them. You ate them all without noticing.
But it's amazing, because you can't tell looking at them either. Not that you should be able to tell, but like they do just look like business.
Yeah, and sometimes you can, yeah. I mean, even if you're not into juicing, and you can just have the other thing that I like to do in order to repurpose food is, you know, if you are a fan of broccoli and you use the florets, but then you feel very guilty when you have, you know, like the big, you know, stem, and you're like, what do I do? Does that go to trash? No, I just shred it and it acts as the juice pulp here. So even in the recipe, I have it like juice pulp or just shredded broccoli or
shredded like on a mandolin.
In a shredder, just very quickly, and then. And you use it for that.
Very good.
Flowers are funny.
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, what was that then? Very nice. Yeah, cool. Oh my God, I need to up my cooking game.
Yeah, it's all about being curious, you know, because it's this kind of thing. It's like the juice bulb. Like, you had the same question mark today, you know, as you just said, you know, it's like, what happens to that? Mm. So when you start like, okay, so I have that juice bulb. What do you do? Is that going to trash? Like, because at the end of the day, it's food that, I mean, you bought. There's your money in there and it's edible. Why wouldn't you use it to eat it? And it's fiber and helps with constipation. Yeah, so.
By heart. Yeah, I'll just speak to you before I ever try and attempt any kind of seed or grain ever again. I'm like, oh, I've just put 18 tablespoons of this. Am I gonna suffer? Yeah. But it's good to know that. I mean, I think it is good to know that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because it has become the inspiration for a lot of the recipes that we have in our blog, because sometimes you just have like some food that is sitting there. It's like, oh, do we trash out or will? It's like we have ended up even like freezing the juice pulp. It's like, no, freeze that. I mean, I'm gonna use it. It's like, are you sure? Just freeze it. I'll use it later. Or one of the...
You're like an Italian nan. You're the Italian nan of plant-based food right now.
Yeah, well...
Leave that stale bread. That's not going to be wasted.
That's bread pudding. No, that's bread pudding.
Or bread crowd. Yeah, it's like... But I think all of the beautiful things, like Italian food, is like cucina povera. Like, you use everything. There's a resourceful nature to it. And it's like some of the dishes that have come out of that style of cooking are like...
Tuscan, some the cebollita, you know, the cebollita.
Tuscan bread soup.
It's just, veggies. Yeah, it's stale bread. I mean, and what happens is that in these big tables, very rich table, there was a thing, you know, in ancient times there where they just to flatter, to say, yeah, I'm a very wealthy person, instead of using bowls, they would use bread bowls. So they would have their soup in a bread bowl, but then the bread was going to trash, but then the people who cooked that meal, they were using that bread like, oh, no, I'm not gonna trash that. And they started to, so there was this big pot, and they just kept feeding the pot with stale bread and, you know, like whatever vegetables were in season. And of course, when they were having soups or stews, it was winter time. So kale and celery. So those are the thing, not tomato, for instance, because it's something that is there from somewhere. So that soup became something because the foods that were available during that time were, you know, of course, the stale bread that we just talked about, but then it's just the kale and all the white beans and so on. And it was a hearty meal because they had the beans, they had their protein, but they were just like the leftovers from the rich people that they just had their dinner, you know, and they would repurpose that those foods and create this ribollita, which means reboiled.
Yeah, right.
That's what means ribollita in Italian. So we have it in the blog as well, because we were so, when we learned about this, when we were in Italy, we were like, That's such a beautiful story. We need to make it with you, Dad. And also the great thing is that you make a big pot and it actually freezes very well. So you just like you thaw it and put it in the microwave or reboil it, and it is meant to be reboiled. It's everybody eat that. You know, so you can just like keep having more hearty soup during the whole winter season just by a big pot that you made. You feel inspired by making, you know, a couple of weeks ago.
The game changer for me for Ribollita was new season olive oil going on top of that as well.
Yeah.
Then it's like so good. So good.
Yeah, I feel very grateful about, and this is, I think that's why the whole thing about this vlog started in Italy, because we were so compelled about so many food stories, because that's the thing in Italy, that everyone has a food story. Even if there are people living in Milano and the hectic thing of the city, of everything, everyone has a, you know, like a nonna that used to cook these things this way, or the ravioli or whatever. Like everyone is so attached to this nostalgia of their food that it really inspires you, you know. So we used to go every single Monday to the market, like to just to be able to talk to the people that sell you that. They're like, how are those strawberries? Oh yeah, yeah, those are these strawberries that we picked from here and there, and then every single ingredient has a story, you know. It's like, wow, now I really want to cook with that.
Yeah.
It's great, guys.
I can see it. I love your passion around it. What I'm interested to know now, though, is if you had to pick one of those bottles, what would you pick and why?
Keeping the orange.
Okay. I'm not going to take it away from you. Keeping the orange.
I think probably, because I'm very compelled by the rosé as well, but I think it's just the new factor, the novelty factor about, like, what you just explained before, you know, just having something in your glass that is not meant to be consumed. And as we have been talking about, I'm very passionate about repurposing things, or things that you might not eat, but guess what? You know, because I think great stories are built around tables, you know, and I think it's a great conversation starter. And when you came from Berlin, when you arrived, we open one of those bottles, not that bottle, but it was an
orange. Celebrity from Aussie, the sparkling orange.
Exactly. And actually, since we met, I hadn't had orange wine before we met.
Really?
So I was introduced to orange wine with you. And that was
at a music festival.
Back in Berlin. So I guess before we're having this talk and before, and because we, I don't know, it's just the stories that get attached with to people and things, you know. For me, if I ever get poured an orange wine, even in 30 years from now, I think I'm gonna think about you. So it's orange for me.
Oh, that's a lot. I really own you. That's nice. Well, hopefully they're gonna be delicious orange wines from here on out. You have one and you're like, it's awful. I was just speaking of you. So I'll be like, oh no. Yeah, and I'll think of I'm gonna re-change my memories around chia seeds now, juice pulp, and just store the old memory away. Anyway, I mean, yeah. Any final thoughts?
Final thoughts? Well, I love.
Other than eating another mushroom, but
yeah, I would need to leave some wine for Joaquin, because Joaquin has been very carefully recording us here, so he's the guy behind the camera the one that is putting our microphones and making sure that everything is working well. So we're very grateful for that. So
okay, I like that as a final thought. Very considerate. The wines that we tried today, for anybody tuning in, is the Quinta do Amicio Vinhaverde 2022 from Vinhaverde in the north of Portugal. And then we've got the 2021 Solazzo from Villa Calicantes, which is coming from Lago di Garda, or from the Veneto region, actually from the Bardolino appellation. And then we have Orsi San Vito non-vintage Posca Bianca, which is coming from the Colli Bolognese, so from Emilia Romagna in Italy. And I implore all of you to visit all of these wineries when you're ever in those places. And of course, you can find your own alternatives with that. And then we've got this beautiful spread of food that has been prepared by these two wonderful men for me. So I'm totally going to be spoiled this afternoon. And just to remind everybody about where to find you.
Our plant-based world.
salt all together. And if you fancy the just Spanish speaking and Spanish speaking blog, because all the recipes we usually populate in both is nomadasgourmet.com altogether. And it's the same thing for all social handles and so on. So hopefully you become a reader.
And you can find me on my Instagram at Vina Lupa, but also Sublime Wine Berlin and then Juice Wine Podcast as well. And that's it today. So I just want to say cheers to everybody who tuned in and a big cheers to Gustavo and Joaquin for doing all of this beautiful spread. And I'm very glad to be here in Malaga.
Yeah. For coming. Cheers for that.